Welcome back to Shattering News. Islam is a horrid religion. Allah was modeled after Satan. Muhammad, by his own admission, was demon-possessed. The Quran is the most despicable book ever written. It is grotesquely immoral. It is a lie. But you know, Islam is not alone when it comes to being untrue, promoting false hope, being immoral. So is the Christian New Testament. Paul was even more anti-Semitic than was Muhammad. Both men were vastly more anti-Semitic than was the most anti-Semitic man of all time, Adolf Hitler, the man perceived to be the most anti-Semitic of all time. Paul's letters are more ruthless and vicious towards Yahweh's chosen people than is Hitler's Mein Kampf. Christianity is every bit as disingenuous, as misguided, as demonically inspired, as is Islam. If you look at the church's history and you read its earliest statements about Jews and how to savagely treat them, to treat them as if they were demons and savages, to have their homes burned, their property stolen, their women raped. It's pervasive in the early text of Christianity from the most highly regarded clerics. In fact, the man whose sermons formed the basis of Roman Catholicism, his homilies, are amongst the most highly regarded in all of history, routinely spoke out about how Christians ought to brutalize Jews and that they should feel no compulsion against stealing their property, burning their homes, confiscating their businesses, and murdering them. I say this because Christians are in the process of celebrating Good Friday. There is no Good Friday, according to Yahweh. It's a pagan abomination. And then they will celebrate Easter Sunday. If you think you are doing so and somehow doing something that pleases God, I have news for you. He views this as a horrible abomination. Fortunately for most Christians that will celebrate Easter Sunday, they're just stupid. They're just dumb as a brick. They haven't bothered to recognize that Easter is a pagan holiday, that there is no reference to Easter, even in their God-forsaken New Testament. That what they're doing is purely akin to what the ancient Babylonians did millennia ago. Right down to their egg-laying bunny. Right down to their Easter ham. Right down to their cross symbols. Right down to the time of year they celebrate it. Right down to the name that they have afforded it, Ishtar. You think that adopting a pagan holiday is pleasing to God when He invited you to attend the days that He facilitated on our behalf, Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, Passover, unyeasted bread, and firstborn children? I got news for you. He hates it. Now, fortunately, if you were just a buffoon, and you have, because your father celebrated Easter, you're going to celebrate Easter. Because you were born a Catholic, you're going to remain a Catholic. Because you were born a Protestant, you're going to remain a Protestant. Because you're influenced by this disgusting society that we live in. And you're going to go along with Easter sunrise services and celebrate Easter. The good news for you is, at the end of your life, you will cease to exist. Be no hell. But bad news is there'll be no heaven either. zero possibility of salvation. It is impossible for anyone who is celebrating Easter to have a relationship with God. If they think they're having a relationship with God, and I get letters all the time from people that believe that they have a real relationship with a Christian God, and he's very real in their lives, I'm telling you that it's a bunch of malarkey. Played mind tricks on yourself so that you fit into the Christian community. If you are actively practicing the religion of Christianity, there is a 0% possibility that you have a relationship with God, that you know God as he is, that God knows you, that you're part of his family, that you'll be admitted to heaven, that you have been saved. No gray area here. It's a 0% possibility. Now, that's not to say that somebody celebrating Easter this year won't ultimately be saved. I'm just telling you that while you are actively practicing Christianity, there is no hope for your soul. None. Zero. There are no Christians in heaven. Never have been. Never will be. Until you come to realize that your religion has lied to you about Easter, about Sunday, about Christmas, about Jesus, about Christ, about the Trinity, about the New Testament, about baptism, about circumcision, about the covenant, about the Torah, about God's name. Until you come to realize that your religion has lied to you about everything that's important, and finally says, you know, it's pretty stupid to continue to embrace and believe a religion that has lied about every single important issue, like the inerrant word of God and Bible being the name of a book and Paul being a spokesperson for God. When you come to realize that evidence and reason are the enemy of your faith, and that everything your religion has told you is false, and maybe for the first time in your life, you say, you know, for the sake of my soul, for the sake of the souls of those I love, for my children's souls, if you are married and have children, I am no longer going to allow myself to be beguiled by what is obviously a pile of disgusting lies. Then maybe for the first time ever, you'll have the opportunity to walk to Yah, to come to know Yahweh, to engage in a relationship with him along the conditions that he has articulated, to enjoy the benefits of the covenant, and to be saved. But so long as you wallow in Christian mythology, so long as you think that today is Good Friday and that this is a weekend to celebrate Easter, you are still on the wrong side of the divide. Now, that's not to say that God can't reach out to and begin a relationship with somebody who's still mired in the muck of religion. He can. You look at Moshe. Now, Moshe, we don't have any evidence that Moshe was religious. But when Yahweh introduced himself to Moshe, Moshe wasn't saved. Moshe wasn't a participant in the covenant. When Yahweh first reached out to Abraham, Abraham was not saved. Abraham wasn't a participant in the covenant. Not initially. And Yahweh still reached out to them. I know that when I began Prophet of Doom, I didn't know the terms and conditions of the covenant. I didn't know about Yahweh's invitations to meet with him on Passover and unyeasted bread and firstborn children, on the promise of seven, on trumpets, of Day of Reconciliations and Sukkot, camping out with God. I didn't know about those things. But, you know, for every one of those examples, for Abraham, for Moshe, for myself, I was open to God's guidance. And everything that he said exposed the flaws in my prior religious faith. And when God pointed out why I should not believe anything that Christianity had told me. I agreed with him. I was receptive. I was willing to go where his words led. I suspect he knew that of Abraham. His words led to the promised land, to the covenant, to a relationship, to salvation. I suspect that Moshe recognized that and was willing to go where Yahweh's words led, which was to exactly the same place, exactly the same way. One came from Babylon, the other out of Egypt. They came to the same place, the same way. I, too, made the same migration, away from Christianity, away from participation in politics, away from being a patriot, into God's family. I was not a member of the covenant when he first reached out. I am now. And I'm here to tell you that I celebrated Easter as a Christian. We had Easter egg hunts for our children. We had Easter brunch with extended family. We dressed up. We often went to church services. I was wrong. I was an embarrassment doing so. And now we celebrate Passover on yeasted bread and firstborn children. And rather than celebrating a pagan and demonic holiday, we celebrate our relationship with Yahweh. I gave up nothing of value and gained a share of the entire universe. The ultimate trade. The best decision I ever made in my life. Same offers for you out there for you. It is possible to come to know God as He is, to engage in a relationship with Him along the terms and conditions that He has provided, and to walk to Him right into His home and live with Him forever. All of those things are possible, but they remain impossible while you remain mired in religion. Until you realize that your religion has lied to you about everything and become open to God's guidance away from religion, there is no hope for your soul. But once you do, if something that is said on this program, something that is written in the books that I've offered for you to read for free, that focus on Yahweh's testimony, if something triggers your willingness to question your religion and go where the words lead, the words will lead you directly to God. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. It is very difficult to ignore the approach of Easter in this culture. It became part of the news and the top of the hour on this program. It dominates us in terms of our stores. It will be ubiquitous that places will be closed for Easter Sunday. Even in Venezuela, as I understand it, now there are these protests that have been underway in Venezuela. They're now combining Easter with their political mandates. It is ubiquitous, and particularly in America. And my guess is that it's ever so slightly less pervasive in certain places throughout Europe, though I bet in Spain and Italy it is as pervasive as it is here in America. And hopefully to a slightly lesser degree, it is ubiquitous in New Zealand and Australia. But there is a reason that God is disgusted by the United States. There's many reasons. But I suspect one of the reasons why in the 18th chapter of Yeshaya, after telling the world that the lot of those who choose to plunder Israel, which is what America is doing, trying to sacrifice the West Bank to garner favor with the oil-rich Islamic nations, to sell more weapons to Islamic nations, that by doing so, you engender God's wrath. But by celebrating Easter, you engender God's animosity. By being a Christian, you engender God's animosity. By for claiming the free expression of religion, you, and encouraging religion, you engender God's animosity. So we should not be surprised by this statement that Yahweh made. This is now the first line of the 18th chapter, but understand there were no chapter breaks in the original scroll of Yahshua. We have a scroll dating back 2,300 years, and it reads as follows. Woe, expressing great dissatisfaction and issuing a warning. To the land of whirling and buzzing wings, which is from the region beyond, situated on the opposite side of the direction of the rivers of Cush, which would be the Nile Delta and upper Mesopotamia. You draw a line from Jerusalem through northern Mesopotamia. It goes through the northern part of Alaska. You draw a line through the Nile Delta from Jerusalem. It goes through the southern Florida Keys and the southernmost part of Texas through the southern part of the Hawaiian Islands. If you draw a line directly from Jerusalem across the Great Sea, through the Straits of Gibraltar, it intersects the northeastern United States, just above Washington, D.C. This nation dispatches envoys by way of the sea, and so in floating vessels on the surface of the waters, the messengers travel swiftly, indulgently, and immorally, without any regard for the consequence of their actions. Oh, my, is that ever America today? This nation of people from different races and places, we are the melting pot, known for that more than any other country in the history of mankind. It's tall, typically intoxicated, most often immodest. And this nation has a propensity to take things away from others. Well, you should look at the America's first 300 years after the invasion of Europeans into this continent. Typically scrub clean, smooth skin, completely shaven, and yet often reckless. These people are feared for causing distress through intimidation and awesomely dreadful acts, but also respected by some for their achievements and capabilities. From here to there, around the world, and beyond, but in a future period of time. This population, which is comprised of many different races, routinely vomits up and spews out nonsense in a strange foreign language, talking down to others, mocking them, while continually marching off to war based on this condescending and moronic rhetoric, always trying to impose its influence, establishing the rules while eagerly expecting to throw native inhabitants out of their land. It aggressively subdues others, trampling them down. This is a country divided by rivers. All of those who inhabit the earth, and also those who dwell in the land, when the sign on the upright pole is lifted up to demonstrate my purpose on the mount, you will actually see it, gaining a perspective to genuinely understand, and also when the shofar, ram's horn, trumpet sounds at this specific time, and conveys this plan, you will be able to hear it and pay attention. We'll return to Shattering Myths and consider this transition from a condemnation and description of the United States to Yahweh showing himself. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. If you consider the rhetoric of the United States vis-a-vis what is occurring in the Ukraine, how we agitated the initial protests in Kiev, and how we have painted everyone into a corner, how we've tongue-lashed everyone, even yesterday as we arrogantly say that we achieved this great success relative to the Ukraine, none of which is even seems remotely feasible or appropriate or fair. President of the United States further demeaned Russia as if he was the stern disciplinarian, and Russia was a out of control wayward child. I've been in a lot of negotiations with various different parties and different interests. I have never ever heard of or experienced any negotiation whereby one party acts belligerently and talks down to the other that achieved any success. the very attitude that was displayed in the words that Yahweh chose with great precision to describe the United States is precisely what we're witnessing in the United States' interference in Ukraine. We have no reason to be there, no reason to stir it up, no reason to speak without first understanding, no reason to be so moronic, so arrogant, and yet we dispatch our fleets to project our power as if we're going to influence this and that everyone else must capitulate. Well, what God says is that he doesn't appreciate that very much. It's arrogant. It's irrational. It's ignorant. It's immoral. It's vicious. It's covetousness on display. God says, I don't like it very much. I don't like it at all. And so God's going to demonstrate the difference between America and himself. A wonderful way to say, you want to trust in patriotism and the American way and great military power? Is that what you want to put your faith in? If that's it, that's your choice. That's Exhibit A. That's man doing man's thing. Patriotic, political, religious. Is that what you want? That's your option. That's option A. I'm going to be option Y. I'm going to be over here. I'm going to make sure, though, that the world at this very moment, because this is when you'll either make a choice to be with option A, America, or option Y, Yahweh, that you know exactly how we differ. So he has articulated what he sees in America, what it represents. That's what you like. That's what you want. You want to be patriotic towards that? That is your choice. Yahweh's going to present the alternative, choosing him. And he's going to put his message on a standard that he's going to raise right above either Mount Moriah or Mount Zion. Can't tell you which one. I suspect perhaps both. In fact, I think both would be a really good call. Because Mount Moriah means revere Yah. If you come to see what candidate A is offering in the election of your life, the election for your soul, if you see what candidate Y is offering on Mount Moriah, you might choose to revere Yah if you're rational. But Mount Zion is a wonderful choice too, because what does Zion mean? It means the signpost on the way. God is going to raise up a sign. Post it. He even says it's a sign that I'm posted on my way. God. The perfect fulfillment of what the name Zion means. One of the three most significant mountains surrounding Jerusalem, the source of our reconciliation. Mount Moriah being one of them. Mount of Olives, symbolic of the Spirit, being another. And the third being Mount Zion. A signpost on the way. And so he's going to shout out what his message represents. He is going to show us the standard of what of his platform, if you will. This is the election of a lifetime. This is the election of all of human history. You got Exhibit A, that's America. You got Exhibit Y, the two candidates. They're vying for your vote. Who are you going to choose? And it is this juxtaposition, this choice between man's militaries, man's political rhetoric, man's religious rubbish, and what God is offering, that he is encouraging you to make a decision. Are you going to choose the Torah or the U.S. Constitution? Are you going to choose him for your security, or are you going to depend on man's militaries, the Department of Homeland, Defense? What are you going to choose? Are you going to rely on the biggest military in the world or the strong arm of Yahweh? Are you going to choose your prosperity with the biggest economy in the world or with the inheritance that comes with the covenant? Are you going to trust men and wrap yourself in the flag? Or are you going to trust God and wrap yourself in his set-apart spirit? It's a very important choice. God's going to make it absolutely clear who the two candidates are, what your two options are. Trumpeting choice A at this very moment in time will be the beast, pure manifestation of evil, the Torahless one. He will be advocating option A. Yahweh will be advocating option Y. He will have two witnesses at this time in Jerusalem articulating the merits of option Y while rebuking option A. That's what's going to happen. He will get your attention. The world will be left without excuse. But whatever you choose at that very moment, whosoever brand you choose to wear, whether it is the brand of the covenant or the brand of this beast, it will determine the eternal fate of your soul. This is a referendum we're having right now between Easter and Passover and Matzah. It's a referendum. What are you going to choose? You're going to choose the myths of man integrated with the desires of Satan? Or are you going to choose the path that Yahweh not only articulated but walked? Which one? You can't have both. Never in the history of humankind has there ever been an option for both, for religion and relationship, for patriotism and for salvation. It is one or the other. That is what's going to happen on this day, and God's going to make it unequivocally clear. Let's continue with the prophecy. God goes on to say that indeed, because here and now, at this point in time, says Yahweh, I will be silent and at peace, removed from the tribulation in a better place, and I will look down, choosing to always be observant, anticipating my desired unending and caring response where I and heaven will benefit. In my dwelling place, from the well-known location and space where the universe was established and where the basis for and the foundation of life, in the manner of radiant and glowing, warm and passionate light, akin to an enveloping cloud which is like encompassing dew, in the warmth and enthusiasm of the harvest. God is going to tell you that the moment that this election takes place, where you can vote for man, candidate A, America, and what it represents, or candidate Y, Yahweh, and what he represents, that the moment he makes that available to you, for the next 3.5 years, he's going to be nowhere to be found on earth other than through that witness, that testimony. That he's going to allow man to do as much damage as man is wants to do in those 3.5 years is going to be a hellish place. The earth itself is going to revolt at the revolting nature of humankind. He's going to spend those 3.5 years doing what he has every right and deserves to do. Enjoying his family. Just prior to this time, as we know, Yahweh's covenant children were harvested. It was a reaping, a gleaning, a secondary harvest. We know that 7,000 souls will be collected from this earth, and Yahweh is going to enjoy his relationship in heaven with these 7,000 children who have just arrived. That's where he's going to be. That's where I'm going to be on this day. I won't be here on this day to help you anymore. Won't be here to point you in the right direction. I'm going to be up there enjoying Yahweh's company. I hope there are more of you there than the numbers indicate today. That's the purpose of this program. I want you to be there with us. But if you're here, make the right choice. He says, indeed, before the approaching presence of the harvest, as the budding blossoms form and become completely perfect, then the hardened and unfit will be dealt with for becoming clusters, clustering as wild birds of prey, listening eagles, falcons, and hawks, and insignificant worthlessness with the worthless squandering and trivializing. They're going to be stopped. They'll be taken down. They're going to be banished. They will be snuffed out with a sharp implement. You see, when God raises his ensign, his sign, his proclamation on Mount Zion and Mount Moriah with sounding his trumpet, at that very moment, the children of Israel, those who have come to recognize that it was Yahweh himself who intervened to blow the Muslims away, that it's Yahweh who is offering the choice between the things of man and the things of God, that at this moment they're going to walk to God along the path that he has provided. They will be celebrating Pesach and Matzah and Bukurim, and they're going to become perfect. They're going to be established in the way. They're going to be preparing themselves to blossom in God's family forever. And they will be distinguished from the hardened and unfit that remain. Welcome back to Shatteringness. We have a longtime archive listener, I think first-time caller, Anthony from New Jersey, who has a couple of questions. Anthony, welcome to the program, and please go ahead.
Hi, Yada. How are you today?
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. A group of us have been listening to you, and we have actually left Christianity. We've left Christianity.
Good for you.
We realize that Christianity is a pagan religion. We've left, okay. But here's our question.
Good.
We've been going through the archives, and we're trying to understand. We read the Torah, and we observe it. But one thing we're trying to get from what you're saying is, we know that there's no word obey, but...
Right.
When you say observe, what do you don't you eventually do what it says to do? That's what we're supposed to.
Okay. All right.
About.
So
we want you to ask the question.
Okay. Okay. We don't have a lot of time here in this 6 minute segment. We're going to do the best we can to answer this, and I'm going to hope that you call back in next week with whatever we don't cover. You are correct. There is no Hebrew. There is no Hebrew word for obey. The word that you'll see rendered obey in English translations is almost universally shema. Shema means to listen.
Yes.
So listen and obeying are just awesomely different concepts. God wants us to listen to him, but he never once asks us to obey him. Now, you are correct in telling our listeners and concluding yourself and your group that Yahweh wants us to observe his Torah. Torah means guidance and teaching, so he wants us to observe his teaching. To observe is to closely examine and carefully consider. Now, if you are given guidance and instruction and you carefully examine it and you thoughtfully consider it, it is likely that you will choose of your own volition to follow and to act upon and respond to some of that guidance. And you will apply that guidance to your life.
But it is a
Okay, so the natural inclination of an informed and rational individual is that if you closely examine and carefully consider highly appropriate instructions that coming directly from God and saying, this is guidance for your life and for your soul, that the likelihood is that over time you're going to say, you know, I understand that, I appreciate it, I like it, I want to apply this to my life. But choosing to do that after you have listened and come to know Yahweh as he is, after you come to understand the covenant that he's offering, and you respond to him based upon what you've learned, that's a far cry from obeying.
Okay, so then the next part would be when we read through the Torah, we get to the now, and we're not talking about rabbinical Judaism. That's thrown.
That's the Talmud, right? That's the Talmud, not the Torah. Right.
Mm-hmm. But when we read the Torah, we see the father describing the Mishkan, the tabernacle, and how to approach it and all of that. I haven't heard you talk about that. At least we're going to the archives. So
okay.
Talk about that. Yes.
Yeah, boy. Now you've brought up a subject that there's no way in the minute and a half that we have left that I can cover. But let me make an attempt. I'm going to make an attempt for it.
Okay.
Most of what's in the Torah, in terms of its guidance, are not things that we can do in the sense of being religious and saying, all right, it says to approach the tabernacle in this way.
Yes.
We can't physically do that because there is no tabernacle today.
Okay.
So we can't do that. So it tells us that Dod, whose real name is the fictitious name is David.
When he
explained to us how to properly observe the Torah, he explained that it's all about focusing on the right things and making connections so that we understand. There is many things in the Torah that we can't physically do, but there's nothing in the Torah that we can't learn from. And since the Torah means teaching, when our observations of the Torah are designed for us to learn something about God, then it opens up all of it, and all of it becomes meaningful. For example, the tabernacle is presented as God's home. Therefore, the tabernacle and the covenant are synonymous. And so God is telling us, how do we approach his home? And what you'll find is all of the symbolism helps us to better appreciate not only the terms and conditions of the covenant, so we don't try to approach God's home covered in the muck of religion, for example, and then we try to approach God's home by trusting and relying on him instead of man's institutions, and so that we come to approach God by becoming perfect, by walking to him along the path to his home that he has provided. All of those insights as to how we approach the tabernacle are consistent with reinforcing how we walk to God and become part of his family. So, Anthony, just great calls. I wish you had called early in the program, but you know, you have the number now, and you know that that I'm encouraging you and your friends to ask these questions, and we would love for you to be part of the program in the weeks and months ahead. Thank you for listening.